So my name is Amanda Zabala. I'm a maternal and child health epidemiologist at Columbus Public Health. And because I work so closely with the community, epidemiologist doesn't really resonate with my community members. So instead, what I say is that I am a person who works with information. And so a lot of times that information includes numbers, but many other times that information includes stories. And so it's my job to make sure that the stories that people tell me are accurately represented to people who make decisions about all of our lives. And that's pretty much the basis of my talk today. So for those of us who work in infant mortality reduction, we're constantly asking ourselves these five questions. Who's being affected by infant mortality? What are the root causes of these infant deaths? Are there certain years in which infant mortality is higher? What zip codes are being affected? And ultimately, why is it that our babies are dying before they reach their first birthdays? So when we look at Franklin County as a whole, overall, every year, we lose about 150 babies before they reach their first birthdays. And this map just shows infant mortality rates by zip code. The green indicates lower infant mortality rates, whereas red and orange indicate higher rates. But the purpose of this map is just to show that infant mortality is everywhere in Franklin County. All of our communities are affected. It's simply that the rates are higher in our most vulnerable neighborhoods that have been historically socially disadvantaged. When we look at our leading causes of infant death in Franklin County, we see that it's primarily prematurity, congenital anomalies, SIDS, and maternal complications that are leading these results. But when we talk about prevention efforts, very rarely do we actually focus on these congenital anomalies. And a lot of times, we don't tend to focus on anomalies because we have pretty proven interventions for the other leading causes. So for preterm birth, we have progesterone. For low birth weight, we can affect mom's health behaviors. And for sleep-related infant deaths, we know the ABCs of safe sleep. But when it comes to congenital anomalies, we tend to assume that all of them are due to random genetic mutations, which makes them, therefore, less preventable than the other leading causes of death. And if we were to intervene, it would require much more complex interventions, which simply isn't true. So the purpose of my talk today is really to make a case we're focusing on congenital anomalies as a leading cause of death. And so to do this, we wanted to first examine our vital statistics data to quantitatively assess trends in anomaly-related deaths. But then we also wanted to bring these data to life. So we made use of our fetal infant mortality review data to qualitatively examine families' experiences with loss. So for the first part of this project, we looked at our data and we saw that about 1 in 33 births are affected by a congenital anomaly. And these anomalies are responsible for close to 1 in 5 deaths in Franklin County. We also know that babies born with a congenital anomaly are twice as likely to be born premature and up to 10 times as likely to die before their first birthdays. So it is, in fact, an issue. When we look at our data over time, overall, congenital anomaly-related losses have been decreasing in Franklin County, which is a very good thing. But when we look at our data by race, we see that it's primarily been an issue among our non-Hispanic white population, but that too has been decreasing over time. So we're doing something right in some sense. But then we look at our data among our non-Hispanic black population. And so in addition to issues with preterm birth and low birth weight and SIDS, we're also seeing an increase in congenital anomaly-related losses among our non-Hispanic black population. When we break down these data by age, we see that congenital anomaly-related loss is primarily an issue among our population over the age of 25. And so while we can't say for sure why that is, we can hypothesize that maybe it's because the birth rates have been, the number of births among our populations have been changing a little bit. So among our populations under the age of 25, they're having fewer babies. They're delaying childbirth. And so among our population over the age of 25, they're having more births. And similarly with infant deaths, we see that there are a number of additional births occurring among our population over the age of 25, especially among our age group 30 to 34. So when we looked at some of the qualitative data, the purpose really was to narrate everything that we found in the quantitative data by using our local family stories. So I'm not sure how many people are familiar with femur data, but we chose this data set because it's a continuous action-oriented quality improvement process that looks at a very select subset of the approximately 280 cases of fetal and infant deaths in Franklin County. And they assess and work to improve the systems that women and families interact with on a day-to-day basis. And compared to other child death review processes, this one is unique in its exploration of the qualitative data and of its incorporation of the family voice. So overall in 2016, 48 cases were reviewed by FEMUR, but when we look at the anomaly-related loss cases, we had 12 of them. And all 12 of them were considered low birth weight and preterm, and there were a number of different anomalies that were identified, primarily related to anencephaly and renal agenesis. And with our moms, we had a 50-50 split between black and white in our anomaly-related losses. And they were primarily between the ages of 20 and 34, though we did have some teenagers who experienced some congenital anomaly-related losses as well. So I should say that FEMUR tracked and identified over 180 present and contributing risk factors to these deaths. And so when we looked at some of the common themes across these cases, these were the 7 leading factors. And these were the ones that were present in the greatest number of cases. They were considered by the FEMUR team to be a contributor to the greatest number of deaths, and they were considered by the team to be the most significant contributor to the fetal or infant death. And so these factors weren't necessarily surprising to us, because what we learned, especially in the previous presentation, was that these are pretty much associated with congenital anomalies. So for example, we know that crucial fetal development tends to occur before 10 weeks gestation. And so when women are getting pregnant before they're ready, they're at an increased risk of developing an anomaly. Additionally, chronic maternal health conditions, including smoking, are associated with anomalies, as well as certain types of infection, depending on their timing during pregnancy. And finally, these women, like all of us, experience multiple stressors, and sometimes that's due to housing or transportation or losing a support person. But these stressors, along with the identification of an anomaly, can exacerbate this stress and require additional needs for referrals, such as home visiting and other support programs. But really, when we looked at family stories of loss, this is really where it brings the data to life. And so across the 12 cases, they had similar stories related to the identification of an anomaly, contemplation about what to do with the pregnancy, the delivery and loss, as well as bereavement after the loss. So one woman said, "They were getting ready to tell me if it was a boy or girl. The nurse just kind of stopped the ultrasound and was like, hold on. The doctor came in and started looking. She said, it's a girl, but your daughter's diagnosed with anencephaly. I asked her what that was, and she said, there's no survival at all. She said, there's pretty much a hole from her eyes up. The whole top of her head was gone, she said. And right now, the laws that we say it's too late to get an abortion. She said that if I wanted to get one to terminate the pregnancy, I'd have to go out of state. And so this story just pretty much touches on the issues that we have communicating with our patients, sympathizing with what they may be going through, as well as the abortion laws that are in place. So in Ohio, a woman can't get an abortion after her 20th week of gestation, and that's oftentimes when an anomaly is actually identified. So around that time, she has no options unless she can find a state that can offer her an abortion if she needs one. Another woman said, I thought about getting an abortion. I called a place and asked them how they did it. By this time, she's got fingers, toes, everything. She's moving all around, very active baby. I didn't think it was right, so I decided to carry the pregnancy out. By the time I was 8 months, my belly was starting to get really big. I was miserable. I couldn't hardly walk, and the doctor said that it was because my baby wasn't swallowing the fluids. The doctor said they couldn't force my pregnancy. They had to just let it go on its own. And so as we heard earlier about early elective deliveries, we have some pretty stringent policies in place. So without a medical indication, even if her child had a lethal diagnosis, there was nothing that the doctors could do. So she was forced to walk around in physical and emotional pain for an extended period of time. Related to delivery and loss, one woman said, it was going so slow at first. They gave me something to kind of speed it up, but I fell asleep. And when I woke up, I was in labor. I woke up yelling for the nurses and stuff. They come in here. I had already gave birth. She kind of like fell right on the bed. So they grabbed her, wrapped her up, and I was like, is she alive? Is she alive? They said her heart was already down to 60. I said, I want to hold her. They wrapped her up and brought her to me. And she opened her eyes and she looked at me. And then it was like glazed. You could just see it. She had just died in my arms. At least she struggled to look at me. She seen me before she went. And so when we're talking about infant mortality and especially congenital anomaly related losses, our vital statistics data don't get at what these women are actually experiencing. It doesn't tell the full story. And so it's important to incorporate other sources that actually do tell the story to make the case for addressing these types of losses. And finally, related to bereavement, another woman said, so I come home and my belly was gone. And I lay down and I was like, where's my baby, you know? She's not here in my belly. I cried and cried for a while. Then I started getting depressed. I wondered, why did this happen to me? But I just think of it as, you know, ever since then, things have been easier on me. And I feel she's my little guardian angel. And so families experience a different type of loss. All families experience a similar feeling of grief, maybe some guilt when they have an infant or fetal mortality. But for women who are experiencing an anomaly-related loss, they need additional supports. They need grief groups that are in their neighborhoods. They need grief groups that are associated with their type of loss. And we typically, in Franklin County, we have a number of grief groups, but we're not entirely sure how many of them are related to the anomalies. So finally, with some recommendations, to address some of the themes as well as the stories that we heard. First is to promote access to and use of effective family planning methods to avoid unintended pregnancy. So that includes asking the one key question and making sure that all methods are offered, including natural family planning and tubal ligation if these moms want that. Second is to conduct ongoing holistic assessment of women's medical and non-medical needs because women are faced with a number of unique stressors, and so it's important for us as public health professionals and as doctors and anyone who interacts with these women to make sure that all of their needs are assessed. And then finally, to layer supports for these women who are carrying a fetus with a known anomaly related, with a known congenital anomaly. So that can include enhanced maternal home visiting, paternal home visiting now as well. But it could also include more referrals to support groups. And so overall, there are a number of implications for this type of work in that families' experiences are much more devastating than vital statistics data would suggest. And every family has a story. Every family that loses an infant before its first birthday, but loses a fetus before it's even born, every story needs to be told, and it's our job as epidemiologists to make sure that that story is told. And a focus on anomaly-related infant death is definitely needed in our infant mortality reduction efforts. Now, going forward, we would like to continue to monitor anomalies by maternal race and ethnicity, age, and geography. These numbers get pretty small when we try to look at all of them together, but if we aggregate enough years of data, hopefully we can do that. We also want to examine the abortion data to see if we can ascertain how many abortions are done because of these genetic, of these congenital anomalies. And the recommendations that we made are similar to the ones that FEMR made in its overall presentation, and we're hoping to present these to the FEMR Community Action Team, who's responsible for implementing new policy, programming, and other actions to address infant mortality. And with that, I would like to acknowledge all of the people that helped me with this, specifically Lauren Rose Cohen, who is the FEMR coordinator in Franklin County, whose work is absolutely invaluable. And if you have any questions, I have my contact information here, and the full FEMR report is available on our website here. Thank you.
My question to you is, like, the abortion data is pretty- do weird things in facilities and things like that. So how would you accomplish incorporating that into your future work?
I wish I had the answer to that, because in Ohio, it's definitely aggregated. They produce a report, so trying to get the actual raw data is pretty complicated, but hopefully we'll find a way to do that. FEMER does track exactly what those stressors are, simply because they're able to actually talk to these families and they get more information than is available in vital records. So a lot of times it's housing, a lot of times it's transportation, or if they are in a domestic violence situation, or a lot of these things aren't actually tracked in birth records. So it's nice that the FEMER program actually looks a little bit deeper. So FEMER actually reaches out to every single family who experiences a loss with resources and grief support options. But for the cases that are actually selected for review, it's through a perinatal periods of risk assessment. So essentially we look at the infant and fetal deaths by birth weight as well as age at death. And so those cases are prioritized depending on certain criteria, as well as three additional risk factors. And there are a number of different risk factors that we can choose from, but if they have an additional three, that's really where we focus on. So these cases receive additional outreach. So the FEMER nurse, there's only one person who's really working on this project, which is insane, but... So she reaches out to them personally by phone, by mail, and in person to try to get them to tell their stories.
Well, thank you again, and thanks to all of our speakers. It was a really great session.